Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. I'm drinking a hot chocolate right now, just so you know what's going on my end of the microphone. It is winter here in Australia, down under in the southern hemisphere. So, my accompaniment for this episode is a lovely Aldi brand hot chocolate. This is not an advertisement for Aldi. I'm just trying to paint a picture for you all. Today we're discussing chapter one of The Enormous Room. But I wanted to read this other little post that was posted by All About Alice. All About Alice said, "Wow, congrats to everyone that made it through The Brothers Karamazov. I finally caught up. I ended up getting a whole month behind due to some family drama." Sad face. "I'm truly impressed with everyone that kept this up through hell or high water, especially Andrew Lewis. Thank you very much. I'm excited to join back in." Oh, I didn't see that. I actually responded saying, "Are you joining us for E.E. Cummings?" But I suppose I didn't read the last sentence of your post. Thanks for the congratulations. And I would like to extend that as well on my behalf to everyone for making it through The Brothers Karamazov and for everyone who participated in the conversations and unlocked all the hidden mysteries in that book. I feel like we got the most out of it. Some more than others, I could say, as a person who didn't exactly love that book. But still, thank you to everyone. And I'm really excited about this new book, The Enormous Room, because I'm enjoying it so far. We're one introduction and one chapter in, and I like it. I do like it. Gua Nardle said, "It lost me too. I've been listening to the audiobook at work to try to catch up, but I still have a few chapters left. I will be joining back very soon." Cool. Well, we'll be happy to have you back, and I'm going to upvote your comment because that's what you do on Reddit. Chapter one. I asked you guys these questions. What was his friend up to, do you think, that got them both in trouble? Did you have a favourite line in this chapter? And what are your first impressions of the prose style of this novel? I am Norwegian, said I like the writing style in the actual book much better. There's a constant flow of sentences that come across as clever and pithy, not hilarious, but witty. Prison, you mean, remarked a confirmed optimist whose disposition had felt the effects of French climate, all being confused by the eloquence of B's unutterable silence. They don't seem that impressive on their own, these sentences, but I really like how distinct the writing is. I still found myself confused sometimes by who characters were, especially TD, but overall it was easy to follow. The creative use of grammar could also trip me up, but it made the chapter fun to read. Yeah, you could call it creative use of grammar or just straight up bad use of grammar. It's one thing I noticed in this book, and it's not really a criticism because I know this guy's a poet and an artist, and grammar is just, you know, if you're a good writer, omit some grammar or make up your own grammar, as long as it's consistent throughout the book. You know, it's your art piece, do whatever you want with it. But I did notice that he did get quite creative with his grammar, and I did wonder, I was like, does he not know? Was he not a very good grammatist? Or is he having a bit of fun with it? I still wonder a little bit. I think the thing that will tell will be the consistency of his grammar use. I think it's pretty unpolished. I noticed in the previous chapter, the first page or so was made up of very overcooked sentences that you felt like you had to go to the laundry, find your ironing board and your iron, crank it all the way up and iron out the sentences. I was stumbling, I was tripping up. It was partly because a new prose style, you know, I've been reading The Brothers Karamazov for 3 months or so that was kind of in my head, and it can be hard to switch, especially with reading out loud, it can be hard to switch to a new author without getting a bit flustered. But also, I had the thought in that first page or two of, like, it's a pretty common problem with inexperienced authors, I could say, or novelists, that they do tend to go in too hot at the very start of their book. Like, they're trying to prove something and they're thinking, like, this is how technical and complicated and this book is going to be. It's going to be like super, everyone's going to call me a genius sort of thing. And they overcook the start thinking they're going to do, you know, what happens in, who wrote Lolita? Lolita. I always forget. Nabokov. Nabokov did it, right? What was his name? Vladimir Nabokov. Thinking that they'll sustain that level of prose. But he didn't do a very good job of those first few pages, I didn't think. Very much open to opinion. But I remember hoping in that first page or so, like, oh, I hope this wears off and he settles into his prose a little bit and stops trying to show off. And then, lo and behold, within two or three pages, it did settle down. It was like the dust settling. And it became a little more readable. So I don't know if that's was just not really what happened, but I just imagined that was what happening, you know, like expecting to see that, and so I saw it, or if that was what happened or what. But yeah, I found it quite difficult to read out loud. Not hard to follow. It was just I kept tripping over my words. Might have partly also been that I was tired. I read it pretty late last night. Yeah, actually it wasn't late, I was just really tired, I was really sleepy for some reason. Okay, now continuing, I am a Norwegian's comment, I got completely sidetracked. I wonder what kind of man Cummings is, treating such a serious situation as if it were just a nice distraction from A and his work at the camp. My assumption about the letters is that B might be a pacifist. He loves the French, but would not bomb the Krauts. I instantly thought of Hacksaw Ridge and Desmond Thomas Doss, who refused to kill and was put in military prison for it. Was that what happened? Do we know why he's in prison, or just because his friend did something? I'm still getting the hang of the names. There's two people called TD, is that correct? And then one is A and one is B? It's confusing. It's probably not that confusing. I just haven't got my head around it yet. What else did you say here? Sorry, there was another point I wanted to make. This is a very slow podcast today. I apologize. What kind of man Cummings is? Yeah. I'm seeing a humorist, right? I think he's looking back on this experience with a lens of how ridiculous was this? Which, by the way, might be a trauma response. If he was traumatized by the situation, sometimes people have to tend to undermine the seriousness of their trauma by dismissing it as ridiculous or silly or humorous. Swim, said the mama fish, he said, I can see why you thought of Thomas Doss. However, it is not true that he was put into military prison because he refused to kill. What is true is that his direct superiors tried to court-martial him for refusing to obey direct order to carry a gun. He was in a holding cell awaiting the court-martial hearing, which ultimately failed because he was registered as a conscientious objector. I've included the relevant passage and link. When he joined the army, Desmond assumed that his clarification as a conscientious objector would not require him to carry a weapon. He wanted to be an army combat medic. As luck would have it, he was assigned to an infantry rifle company. He refused to carry a gun, caused a lot of trouble among his fellow soldiers. They viewed him with disdain and called him a misfit. One man in the barracks warned him, Doss, as soon as we get into combat, I'll make sure you won't come back alive. His commanding officers also wanted to get rid of the skinny Virginian, who spoke with a gentle southern drawl. They saw him as a liability. Nobody believed a soldier without a weapon was worthwhile. They tried to intimidate him, scold him, assign him extra tough duties, and declared him mentally unfit for the army. Then they attempted to court-martial him for refusing a direct order to carry a gun, but they failed to find a way to toss him out, and he refused to leave. He believed his duty was to obey God and serve his country. Hell of a story. I haven't seen Hacksaw Ridge because those war epics sometimes are a bit too grisly. Same reason I haven't seen Saving Private Ryan. Although I did watch the War and Peace miniseries. That had some pretty grisly war in it. Anyway, thanks for that little side story about Desmond Doss. Rockstar Bottom said, I'm definitely suffering a little whiplash from spending so long with Dosto. I like that we are dealing with a smart-ass Harvard boy. I didn't realise he was a smart-ass Harvard boy. That kind of adds a little edge to the story. Might explain his sensibility a little bit. Cheeky, smart-ass, wisecracking. And doesn't really explain his lack of grammar, though. Techrific said, doubtless the official stethoscope was on the heart of the world just then, and perhaps it was too much to expect that even a postcard would be wasted on private heartaches. It isn't easy having a positive outlook on life when being in dire straits. It takes willpower and tremendous strength. I can't find the poem just now, but Cummings wrote somewhere that I too have slept with somebody else's boot at the corner of my mouth. Nice line. My mind went to Roberto Benigni's movie, It's a Beautiful Life, La Vita Bella, and how he illustrated how powerful humour as a coping mechanism really is. If you look upon the world as essentially benevolent, as a place where love begets love, you might not be considered wise, but you sure are brave. To be life-affirming in the darkest corner of the universe, in the darkest hour of your life, it's a transformative thing. I'm really liking what I've read so far. I also realise that I have neglected E.E. Cummings. I'm very interested to read more of his work. On the back of my copy, which I don't have on me, so I can't read it exactly, but it says something along the lines of, it has earned its place, this book has earned its place among the greats, and it mentions Hemingway, like, earned its place with his contemporaries, Hemingway. So that piqued my interest. Nifty Riffic said, Andrew Lewis, no relation to Tech Riffic, just a complete coincidence. I totally relish verbose and colourful prose and found the first chapter to be rather humorous, akin to, I felt, Catch-22 or Tom Robbins' novel. Yeah, Catch-22 is a pretty good comparison, isn't it? You got the war vibe, you got the humour. For sure, I can see that. The lively satisfaction which we might be suspected of having derived from the accomplishment of a task so important in the saving of civilization from the clutches of Prussian tyranny was in some degree inhibited, unhappily, by a complete absence of cordial relationships between the man whom fate had placed over us and ourselves. Such a lofty sentence. So, not assigning characters complete names, I wonder if this was intentional for character development, perhaps censorship, or perhaps left from the draft of the novel. And I wonder too, is this technique called something specific? My favourite line, prison, you mean, remarked a confirmed optimist, whose disposition has felt the effects of French climate. Man, I stumble and fumble over these sentences in this book. I hope that they start to fall into place a little bit, because every time I read even a little snippet, I find myself like tripping over my words. Swim said, the Mama Fishy said, regarding not assigning names completely, since this is an autobiographical novel, I believe this is a device Cummings used to preserve people's anonymity. For example, B's real last name is Brown. Cool. Okay, that's good to know. My F said, I liked this line. This must be a general, at least, I thought, regretting the extremely undress character of my uniform, which uniform consisted of overalls and a cigarette. Swim said, the Mama Fishy said, question one, Cummings served as an ambulance driver during the war in late 1917. His friend and colleague William Slater Brown, known in the book as B, was arrested by French authorities as a result of anti-war sentiments B had expressed in some letters. When questioned, Cummings stood by his friend and was also arrested. Okay, cool. Did I miss that? I mean, I think I knew that much, but I didn't really, like, I knew that his friend had written a letter and that the French had thought, you know, he's expressing something they didn't like. I knew that much. But what exactly was he expressing? Like, was he up to something? Was he planning something? Was he just running his mouth? Eula is a pimp. Welcome to the podcast, Eula is a pimp. I like your username. Eula is a pimp said, In prose, it's obviously nothing like Kafka, but the tone is really similar, with the EE's playful, almost disinterested narration, responses crashing up against the obvious bureaucratic hell which is about to consume his life. The prose is a bit different than what I expected from his poetry. I can't quite say what I thought it would be, but it definitely wasn't this. Maybe I expected something more earnest. I really enjoyed the description of his judges in particular. Two belonged to a lawyerish person in civilian clothes with a bored expression, plus a mustache of dreamy proportions, with which the owner constantly imitated a gentleman's ringing for a drink. Dreamy proportions. A mustache of dreamy proportions. That's a hell of a description. I like that one too. All right. That's chapter one. That's as deep as we're going to go on chapter one for today. Pretty good effort, guys, I think. We're ready to move on to chapter two, which is called En Route. I put the bedroll down. I stood up. Hey, wait, before I do that, did anyone else notice? I didn't say this in the discussion. Did anyone else notice that he switches from past tense to present tense seemingly accidentally? He did it a couple of times in chapter one. That's really quite strange, isn't it? Sorry, okay, continuing. I put the bedroll down. I stood up. I was myself. An uncomfortable joy gutted me after 3 months of humiliation, of being bossed and herded and bullied and insulted. I was myself and my own master. In this delirium of relief, hardly noticing what I did, I inspected the pile of straw, decided against it, set up my bed, disposed the roll on it, and began to examine my cell. I have mentioned the length and breadth. The cell was ridiculously high, perhaps 10 feet. The end, with the door in it, was peculiar. The door was not placed in the middle of this end, but at one side, allowing for a huge iron can waist high which stood in the other corner. Over the door and across the end, a grating extended. A slit of sky was always visible. Whistling joyously to myself, I took 3 steps, which brought me to the door end. The door was massively made, all of iron or steel, I should think. It delighted me. The can excited my curiosity. I looked over the edge of it. At the bottom, reposefully, lay a new human turd. I have a sneaking mania for woodcuts, particularly when used to illustrate the indispensable psychological crisis of some outworn romance. There is in my possession at this minute a masterful depiction of a tall, bearded, horrified man who, clad in an anonymous rig of goat skins, with a fantastic umbrella clasped weakly in one huge paw, bends to examine an indication of humanity in the somewhat cubist wilderness whereof he had fancied himself the owner. It was then that I noticed the walls. Arm high, they were covered with designs, mottos, pictures. The drawing had all been done in pencil. I resolved to ask for a pencil at the first opportunity. There had been Germans and Frenchmen imprisoned in this cell. On the right wall, near the door, was a long selection of Gauthier. How do you say that? Gauthier. Goethe? God. Laboriously copied. Near the other end of this wall, a satiric landscape took place. The technique of this landscape frightened me. There were houses, men, children, and there were trees. I began to wonder what a tree looks like and laughed copiously. The back wall had a large and exquisite portrait of a German officer. The left wall was adorned with a yacht flying the number 13. My beloved boat was inscribed in German underneath it. Then came a bust of a German soldier, very idealized, full of unfear. After this, a masterful crudity, a doughnut-bodied rider, sliding with fearful rapidity down the acute backbone of a totally transparent sausage-shaped horse, who was moving simultaneously in 5 directions. The rider had a bored expression as he supported the stiff reins in one fist, his further leg assisted in his flight. He wore a German soldier's cap and was smoking. I made up my mind to copy the horse and rider at once, so soon, that is, as I should have obtained a pencil. Last I found a drawing surrounded by a scrawled motto. The drawing was a potted plant with 4 blossoms. The 4 blossoms were elaborately dead. Their death was drawn with a fearful care. An obscure deliberation was exposed in the depiction of their drooping petals. The pot tottered very crookedly on a sort of table, as near as I could see. All around ran a funereal scroll. I read, "My farewell to my beloved wife, Gabby." A fierce hand, totally distinct from the former, wrote in proud letters above, "Punished for desertion, 6 years of prison, military degradation." It must have been 5 o'clock. Steps, a vast cluttering of the exterior of the door. By whom? Huang opens the door. Turnkey creature extending a piece of chocolate with extreme and surly caution. I say, "Merci," and seize the chocolate. Clang shuts the door. I am lying on my back. The twilight does mistily bluish miracles through the slit over the Wang Clang. I can just see leaves, meaning tree. Then, see, this is in present tense. I am lying on my back. I can see leaves. Then, from the left and way off, faintly broke a smooth whistle, cool like a peeled willow branch, and I found myself listening to an, and now it's in past tense again, and I found myself listening to an air from Petrushka, which we saw in Paris at the Chalet Mon Ami et Moi. The voice stopped in the middle, and I finished the air. This code continued for a half hour. It was dark. I had laid a piece of my piece of chocolate on the windowsill. As I lay on my back, a little silhouette came along the sill and ate that piece of a piece, taking something like 4 minutes to do so. He then looked at me, I then smiled at him, and we parted, each happier than before. My cellule was cool, and I fell asleep easily, thinking of Paris. Awakened by a conversation whose vibrations I clearly felt through the left wall. Turnkey creature. What? A mouldy, mouldering, molish voice suggesting putrefying tracts of and orifers answers with a cobwebbish patience so far beyond despair as to be indescribable. La soupe. Well, the soup, I just gave it to you, Monsieur Savvy. Must have a little something else. My money is chez le directeur. Please take my money, which is chez le directeur, and give me anything else. All right. The next time I come to see you today, I'll bring you a salad, a nice salad, monsieur. Thank you, monsieur, the voice moulded. Clang! And says the turnkey creature to somebody else, while turning the lock of Monsieur Savvy's door, taking pains to raise his voice so that Monsieur Savvy will not miss a single word through the slit over Monsieur Savvy's huang clang. That old fool always asks for things. When supposest thou will he realize that he's never going to get anything. Grubbing at my door. Wang. The faces stood in the doorway, looking me down. The expression of the faces identically turnkeyish, i.e. stupidly gloating, ponderously and imperturbably tickled. Look who's here. Who let that in? The ripe body collapsed sufficiently to deposit a bowl just inside. I smiled and said, "Good evening, sirs. The can stinks." They did not smile and said, "Naturally." I smiled and said, "Please give me a pencil, I want to pass the time." They did not smile and said, "Directly." I smiled and said, "I want some water, if you please." They shut the door, saying, "Later." Clang and footsteps. I contemplate the bowl which contemplates me. A glaze of greenish grease seals the mystery of its content. I induce 2 fingers to penetrate the seal. They bring me up a flat sliver of cabbage and a large, hard, thoughtful, solemn, uncooked bean. To pour the water off, it is warmish and sticky, without committing a nuisance, is to lift the cover of capu, I did, thus leaving beans and cabbage slivers, which I ate hurryingly, fearing a ventral misgiving. I passed a lot of time cursing myself about the pencil, looking at my walls, my unique interior. Suddenly I realized the indisputable grip of nature's humorous hand. One evidently stands on capu in such cases. Having finished, panting with stink, I tumble on the bed and consider my next move. The straw will do. Ouch. But it's dirty. Several hours elapse. Steps, and fumble, clang, repetition of promise to Monsieur Savvy, etc. Turnkeyish and turnkeyish identical expression, one body collapses sufficiently to deposit a hunk of bread and a piece of water. Give your bowl. I give it, smiled, and said, well, how about that pencil? Pencil? TC looked at TC. They recited then the following word, tomorrow, clang, and footsteps. So I took matches, burnt, and with just 60 of them wrote the first stanza of a ballade. Tomorrow I will write the second. Day after tomorrow the third. Next day the refrain. After, oh well. My whistling of Petrushka brought no response this evening. So I climbed on Kapu, whom I now regarded with complete friendliness. The new moon was unclosing, sticky wings in dusk, a far noise from near things. I sang a song, the dirty Frenchman taught us, Mon ami et moi. The song says, Bonsoir, Madame de la Lune. I did not sing out loud, simply because the moon was like a mademoiselle, and I did not want to offend the moon. My friends, the silhouette and la lune, not counting Kapu, whom I regarded almost as part of me, then I lay down and heard, but could not see the silhouette, eat something or somebody, and saw, but could not hear, the incense of Kapu mount gingerly upon the taking air of twilight. The next day, promised to Mr. Savvy, to M. Savvy, Wang, my pencil. You don't need a pencil, you're going away. When? Directly. How directly? In an hour or two. Your friend has already gone before. Get ready. Clang. And steps. Everyone very sore about me. I should worry. However, 1 hour, I guess. Steps. Sudden throwing of door open. Pause. Come out, American. As I come out, toting bed and bedroll, I remarked, I'm sorry to leave you. Which made TC furiously to masticate his insignificant mustache. Escorted to the bureau, where I am turned over to a very fat gendarme, this is the American. The VFG eyed me and read my sins in his pork-like orbs. Hurry, we have to walk, he ventured, sullenly and commandingly. Himself stooped puffingly to pick up the segregated sack, and I placed my bed, bedroll, blankets, and ample pelisse under one arm, my 150-odd-pound duffel bag under the other. Then I paused. Then I said, where's my cane? The VFG, Harit, had a sort of fit, which perfectly became him. I repeated, gently, when I came to the bureau, I had a cane. I don't give a damn about your cane, burbled my new captor, frothily, his pink eyes, evil, swelling with wrath. I'm staying, I replied calmly, and sat down on a curb in the midst of my ponderous trinkets. A crowd of gendarmes gathered. One didn't take a cane with one to prison. I was glad to know where I was bound, and thanked this communicative gentleman. All criminals weren't allowed canes, or where exactly did I think I was, in the Tuileries? Asks a rube movie cop personage. Very well, gentlemen, I said. You will allow me to tell you something. I was beet-coloured. In America, that sort of thing isn't done. This haughty inaccuracy produced an astonishing effect, namely, the predistigitorial vanishment of the VFG. The VFG's numerous confreres looked scared and twirled their whiskers. I sat on the curb and began to fill a paper with something which I found in my pockets, certainly not tobacco. Splatter, splatter, fizz, pop, the VFG is back with my oak branch in his raised hand, slithering opprobria and mostly crying. Is that huge piece of wood what you call a cane? It is. Is it? What? How? What the? So on. I beamed upon him and thanked him and explained that a dirty Frenchman had given it to me as a souvenir and that I would now proceed. Twisting the handle in the loop of my sack, and hoisting the vast parcel under my arm, I essayed twice to boost it on my back. This is to the accompaniment of hurry, 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 hurry. The third time I sweated and staggered to my feet completely. A accoutred. Down the road, into the vial, curious looks from a few pedestrians, a driver stops his wagon to watch the spider and his outlandish fly. I chuckled to think how long since I had washed and shaved. Then I nearly fell, staggered on a few steps, and set down the two loads. Perhaps it was the fault of the strictly vegetarian diet. At any rate, I couldn't move a step further with my bundles. The sun sent the sweat along my nose in tickling waves, and my eyes were blind. Hereupon I suggested that the VFG carry part of one of my bundles with me, and received no answer. I am doing too much for you as it is. No gendarme is supposed to carry a prisoner's baggage. I said then, I'm too tired. He responded, you can leave here anything you don't care to carry further. I'll take care of it. I looked at the gendarme. I looked several blocks through him. My lip did something like a sneer. My hands did something like fists. At this crisis, along comes a little boy. May God bless all males between 7 and 10 years of age in France. The gendarme offered a suggestion in these words. Have you any change about you? He knew, of course, that the sanitary official's first act had been to deprive me of every last cent. The gendarme's eyes were fine. That reminded me of... Never mind. If you have change, said he, you might hire this kid to carry some of your baggage. Then he lit a pipe, which was made in his own image, and smiled fatly. But herein the VFG had bust his milk jug. There is a slit of a pocket made in the uniform of his criminal on the right side, and completely covered by the belt which his criminal always wears. His criminal had thus outwitted the gumshoe fraternity. The goss could scarcely balance my smaller parcel, but managed, after 3 rests, to get it to the station platform. Here I tipped him something like 2 cents, all I had, which, with dollar big eyes, he took and ran. A strongly built, groomed Apache, smelling of cologne and onions, greeted my VFG with that affection which is peculiar to gendarmes. On me he stared cynically, then sneered frankly. With a little tooty shriek, the funny train tottered in. My captors had taken pains to place themselves at the wrong end of the platform. Now they encouraged me to hurry, 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 hurry. I managed to get under the load and tottered the length of the train to a car especially reserved. There was one other criminal, a beautifully smile, shortish man, with a very fine blanket wrapped in a waterproof oilskin cover. We grinned at each other. The most cordial salutation, by the way, that I have ever exchanged with a human being, and sat down opposite one another, he plus my baggage, which he helped me lift in, occupying 1 seat, the gendarme sandwich, of which I formed the piece de resistance, the other. The engine got under way after several feints, which pleased the Germans, so that they sent several scout planes right over the station, train, us, et tu. All the French anti-craft guns went off together for the sake of sympathy. The guardians of the peace squinted cautiously from the respective windows and then began to debate on the number of the enemy while their prisoners smiled at each other appreciatively. Il fait chaud, said this divine man, prisoner, criminal, or what not, as he offered me a glass of wine in the form of a huge tin cup overflowed from the canteen in his slightly unsteady and delicately made hand. He is Belgian. Volunteered at beginning of war, permission at Paris, overstayed by 1 day. When he reported to his officer, the latter announced that he was a deserter. I said to him, it's funny. It is funny. I should have come back, of my own free will, to my company. I should have thought that, being a deserter, I would have preferred to remain in Paris. The wine was terribly cold, and I thanked my divine host. Never have I tasted such wine. They had given me a chunk of war bread in place of blessing when I left Noyon. I bit into it with renewed might, but the divine man across from me immediately produced a sausage, half of which he laid simply upon my knee. The halving was done with a large, keen, poilu's knife. I have not tasted a sausage since. The pigs on my either hand had by this time overcome their respective inertias and were chomping cheek-murdering chunks. They had quite a layout, a regular picnic lunch, elaborate enough for kings and even presidents. The VFG, in particular, annoyed me by uttering alternate chompings and belchings. All the time he ate, he kept his eyes half shut, and a mist overspread the sensual meadows of his coarse face. His two reddish eyes rolled devouringly towards the blanket in its waterproof roll. After a huge gulp of wine, he said thickly, for his huge moustache was crusted with saliva-tinted half-moistened shreds of food. "You will have no use for that machine, Labas. They are going to take everything away from you when you get there, you know. I could use it nicely. I have wanted such a piece of rubber for a great while in order to make me a raincoat. Do you see? Gulp. Swallow. Here I had an inspiration. I would save the blanket cover by drawing these brigands' attention to myself. At the same time, I would satisfy my inborn taste for the ridiculous. Have your pencil, I said, because I am an artist in my own country and will do your picture. He gave me a pencil. I don't remember where the paper came from. I posed him in a pig-like position, and the picture made him chew his moustache. The apache thought it very droll. I should do his picture too at once. I did my best, though protesting that he was too beautiful for my pencil, which remark he countered by murmuring as he screwed his moustache another notch. Never mind, you will try. Oh yes, I would try, all right, all right, he objected, I recall, to the nose. By this time the divine deserter was writhing with joy. If you please, monsieur, he whispered radiantly. It would be too great an honour, but if you could, I should be overcome. Tears, for some strange reason, came into my eyes. He handled his picture sacredly, criticising it with precision and care, finally bestowed it in his inner pocket. Then we drank. It happened that the train stopped and the Apache was persuaded to go out and get his prisoner's canteen filled. Then we drank again. He smiled as he told me he was getting 10 years. 3 years at solitary confinement was it, and 7 working in a gang on the road. That would not be so bad. He wished he was not married, had not a little child. The bachelors are lucky in this war, he smiled. Now the gendarmes began cleaning their beards, brushing their stomachs, spreading their legs, collecting their baggage. The reddish eyes, little and cruel, woke from the trance of digestion and settled with positive ferocity on their prey. You have no use. Silently, the sensitive, gentle hands of the divine prisoner undid the blanket cover. Silently, the long, tired, well-shaped arms passed it across to the brigand at my left side. With a grunt of satisfaction, the brigand stuffed it in a large pouch, taking pains that it should not show. Silently, the divine eyes said to mine, "What can we do, we criminals?" And we smiled at each other for the last time, the eyes and my eyes. A station. The Apache descends. I follow with my numerous affairs. The divine man follows me, the VFG him. The blanket roll containing my large fur coat got more and more unrolled. Finally, I could not possibly hold it. It fell. To pick it up, I must take the sack off my back. Then comes a voice. "Allow me, if you please, monsieur." And the sack has disappeared. Blindly and dumbly, I stumble on with the roll, and so at length we come into the yard of a little prison, and the divine man bowed again under my great sack. I never thanked him. When I turned, they'd taken him away, and the sack stood accusingly at my feet. Through the complete disorder of my numbed mind, flicker jabbings of strange tongues. Some high boy's voice is appealing to me in Belgian, Italian, Polish, Spanish, and beautiful English. "Hey, Jack, give me a cigarette, Jack." I lift my eyes. I am standing in a tiny oblong space, a sort of court. All around, two-story wooden barracks, little crude staircases lead up to doors, heavily chained and immensely padlocked, more like ladders than stairs. Curious hewn windows, smaller in proportion than the slits in a doll's house. Are these faces behind the slits? The doors bulge incessantly under the shock of bodies hurled against them from within. The whole dirty no-view business about to crumble. Glance one, glance two. Directly before me, a wall with many bars fixed across one minute opening. At the opening, 15 grins. Upon the bars, hands, scraggy and bluish white. Through the bars, stretching of lean arms, incessant stretchings. The grins leap at the window, hands belonging to them catch hold, arms belonging to the hands stretch in my direction. An instant, the new grins leap from behind the knock and knock off the first grins which go down with a fragile crashing like glass smashed, hands wither and break, arms streak out of sight, sucked inward. In the huge potpourri of misery, a central figure clung, shaken but undislodged, clung like a monkey to central bars, clung like an angel to a harp, calling pleasantly in a high boyish voice, "Oh, Jack, give me a cigarette." A handsome face, dark Latin smile, musical fingers strong, I waded suddenly through a group of gendarmes. They stood around and me, watching with a disagreeable curiosity my reaction to this, strode fiercely to the window. Trillions of hands, quadrillions of itching fingers. The angel monkey received the package of cigarettes politely, disappearing with it into the hollowing darkness. I heard his high boy's voice distributing cigarettes. Then he leapt into sight, poised gracefully against two central bars, saying, "Thank you, Jack, good boy." "Thanks, merci, gracias." A deafening din of gratitude reeked from within. "Put your baggage in here," quoth an angry voice. "No, you will not take anything but one blanket in your cell, understand?" In French. Evidently the head of the house speaking. I obeyed. A corpulent soldier importantly led me to my cell. My cell is two doors away from the monkey angel, on the same side. The high boy voice, centralized in a torrent-like halo of stretchings, followed my back. The head himself unlocked a lock. I marched coldly in. The fat soldier locked and chained my door. 4 feet went away. I felt in my pocket, finding 4 cigarettes. I am sorry I did not give these also to the monkey, to the angel. Lifted my eyes and saw my own harp. All right, there we go. That's chapter 2. Ooh, I really like this. Got a beautiful prose. Flowing. Very poetic. Have your say over at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. I look forward to seeing your comments. Thanks for listening today, and I'll see you tomorrow.